We would like to start our afternoon session. And as you know, this panel is going to deal with a very contemporary issue of the Arab Spring and its continuation with all the problems that have come up. And specifically, Turkey's reaction to the Arab Spring and the role that it has played and it is going to play for many years in talking about democracy in the Middle East. It was pointed out that there is no Arab example of a democratic regime. There has never been, with the possible exception of Lebanon, for a short period of time. Well, things changed quite dramatically. And as was pointed out this morning, we now have at least one fledgling democracy in the Arab world, Tunisia. And Turkey, of course, has been fortunate to have been the exception in the region and has had a very important role to play, particularly in the past year or so, in giving support to some of these movements. We have two highly qualified people to talk about this issue. My name, first of all, is Ali Banu-Azizi, and I teach in the Political Science Department at BC, and together with my colleague, Professor Kathleen Bailey, we also manage, and a number of other colleagues, what is called the Program in Islamic Civilization and Societies at Boston College. Our two speakers, whose order of presentation will be reversed, are Professor Joshua Walker, who is currently an assistant professor of leadership studies at the University of Richmond, and a postdoctoral fellow at the Crown Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis. He is also currently the director of Turkey or Turkish studies within the German Marshall Fund. Professor Walker received his PhD in politics and public policy from Princeton and his MA from Yale University and his BA before that from the University of Richmond. We haven't given specific titles to the individual presentations, but it will generally be on the Arab Spring and Turkish reactions and role then and now. Professor Walker.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to stand just so I can see everybody in the very back. I know I see some of the students that I had a chance to talk to yesterday, so I'll make sure you can hear me. And I want to first start by just thanking everyone. It's always difficult right after lunch to keep everyone's attention. Everyone begins to slump a little bit. You're feeling the food digesting in your stomach, and the last thing you want to do is to hear a droning voice like mine. Hopefully I can be as energetic and try to keep you as involved as I think the topic we have for today is. You know, you can tell you're not in Washington anymore when you land in Boston, and from this morning onward, we really haven't mentioned geopolitics, geostrategy. In Washington, the order is always reversed. If we were doing this conference in Washington, we would start with Turkey as a model, its geopolitical implications of the Arab Spring, and maybe by the end of the afternoon when everyone had left, we might talk about religion, maybe gender, perhaps immigrants. But it's great to be back in Boston where the intellectual fervor is still here. But I do feel a little bit like a fish out of water now that I'm down in Washington at the German Marshall Fund. Omer is a good friend, and Omer is probably one of the best scholars that focuses on Turkey. So rather than treading on his territory, we're going to try to do a division of labor here. I'm going to focus on the geopolitical kind of foreign policy implications, and then Omer Bey is going to kind of take it right where I left off, hopefully, and focus on the domestic that might connect to some of the things we heard earlier. But I'm going to really try to do the best I can in the time I have to talk about this topic of the Turkish model. Indeed, anybody who's been paying attention to the news would think that this year was the year of Turkey, because you hear about Turkey, you see Turkey, and almost everything. And those of us that have been working on Turkey for a while, it's slightly frustrating because it's kind of like you've known this for so long and just suddenly the entire world has discovered something. It's a little bit like Istanbul and Turkey is a tourist destination. You kind of go there and now you're slightly irritated that all these people from the Arab world, all these Iranians, all these Americans, all these Russians have invaded your pristine area that you used to live in, and really all you have to do is speak Turkish. Now I rarely hear Turkish when I go to the most fluent areas of Istanbul, and I feel like a foreigner when I'm going into Taksim, even though I've spent a lot of time working on these issues. And I think that describes the new Turkey in many ways, right? The new Turkey is in many ways a perception, it's an ideal type. It's this new and emerging power in the world that has been classified as being kind of one of the most important. In my own work, I think about countries like Brazil, Turkey, India, and Indonesia, and think about them as swing states, pivotal nations. If the United States gets our policies right in these countries, then whatever happens otherwise, whatever happens with China, whatever happens with Russia, these democracies will be the future. Because the world order that we live in today, that is still based on the World War II model and the Cold War model, has to change. It's very clear that the world in which we live in is no longer going to be dominated by a super cowboy who runs around the world and fixes problems everywhere, because we just don't have that military might like we used to. And even though we're able to destroy countries, we're not able to build nations. And I think in that case, countries like Turkey offer a great example, both from a historical perspective. We've heard a little bit this morning, and I think we can go on further, talking about Turkey's role in this region. Whenever I start to talk about the changes that we've seen in Turkey in the last 10 years, that you really have to think about to understand where Turkey came from, because Turkey didn't emerge in a vacuum. It wasn't like Turkey just appeared out of nowhere as a Muslim majority, secular, NATO member, EU aspirant, head of the Organization of Islamic Conference States, the fastest growing economy in Europe, the largest economy in the Middle East, and the list goes on and on and on to make it kind of the heavyweight that it's become in its region. It's impossible to talk about that without talking about the changes in the international order. And I would argue that what we've seen in the last year, in many ways because of external factors, have been a confluence with what's been going on in Turkey for the last 10 years. You know, Turkey's own economic miracle, its own success, is rooted not in the financial crisis that the West faced in 2008 and has continued to face onward, but a financial crisis that was completely separate in 2001. And the AKP, the Justice and Development Party that has come to power, in many ways, did not come to power on the back of an Islamist movement. I think this is a misnomer. Whenever you use the terms like moderate Islam, like our speaker this afternoon was pointing out, or you talk about mildly Islamist, it's a challenge, because this group that has come to power certainly grew up in a certain conservative Muslim theology in terms of their view of how politics and the world works. But at the same time, they rejected it. They are not from the Erbakan Party. They started and created their own party outside of that movement. And so they grew up with the coups in modern Turkey. They saw the soft coup of 1998. And so when 2001 came and there was this economic crisis, their message to the electorate was, elect us, we're the clean party. Ak in Turkish means white or clean. It's the Akdeniz, the Mediterranean. So vote for us not because we're conservative Muslims, but because we're like you and we will fix the economy. And in many ways, the 34% they captured in the popular election that gave them over 60% in the parliamentary system in Turkey, because of this weird quirkiness of having the highest threshold to enter parliament at 10%, allowed the AKP to garner a large level of support outside of the traditional kind of Anatolian heartland, which was already in favor of the AKP. So this political movement that began in 2002 and has sustained itself over the last 10 years, over three different elections in which each time they've increased their vote share, is something that in many ways was a quiet phenomenon within Turkey, but has only recently been discovered by the West and by the international community, precisely because some of the changes that have been effected in the last 10 years are directly applicable to the Arab Spring. Now, of course, the Turkish model is not a new one. In the 1990s, at the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union, everyone used the idea of the Turkish model in Central Asia. And there was a lot of euphoria within Turkey about these long-lost brothers that spoke the same language as us, and they had been oppressed by the Soviet Empire. Now it's time, our time in the world. There was a lot of rhetoric about the Turkic world that Turgut Özal and then Süleyman Demirel, presidents of the Turkish Republic, used to talk about the Turkish world from the Adriatic all the way to the Great Wall of China. And this kind of euphoria was very quickly squashed because the rhetoric didn't meet with the realities. Turkey at that time did not have the economy that it does today. It really didn't use many of the typical mechanisms of power because in many ways it was hoping that the United States and other champions of it would do the hard work and they could just take the credit for it. And the major change that we saw was this kind of realization in Turkey that you can't just say something, you actually have to back it up. It's one thing to have principles, but it's another thing to actually have realistic means and tools of diplomacy to influence it. And of course, the miscalculation in Ankara was that the Central Asian republics that had just emerged out of the shadow of one big brother wanted another big brother. They didn't want another big brother, they wanted a friend. And at that point in time, the Turks did not seem to be as open to that and still had this patronizing attitude. And what I would argue is that what we're seeing today has been the Turks learning from these mistakes of the past. And I'm not necessarily saying these are mistakes of just one government. From the 1990s to 2000, Turkey was in absolute turmoil because of the political mess and the number of political parties, multi-party democracies, having different prime ministers every year. And so what Turkey has experienced in the last 10 years, in terms of having one party that has been hegemonic in a political sense, there is an opposition, there are opposition parties in Turkey, but I would not call them real alternative parties. You know, the Turkish Gandhi, the new leader of the Republican People's Party, has not offered a real alternative vision for Turkey. It still tends to be reflexive and reactive. When Prime Minister Erdogan says the sky is blue, the opposition party says it's blue, it's black, and you say, why? It's not because there's any particles. They say, well, because Erdogan said it's blue, it cannot be blue. That's their policies in a lot of ways, which is very destructive in many ways. You need to have true kind of constructive alternative opposition parties, something that Turkey has not had during this period of time, and I think it actually hurts the AKP. It helps. It hurts the Justice and Development Party, what they've tried to do. So having laid that out as a brief framework, I think that when we talk about the model of Turkey in the Arab Spring, you can't start just in Tunisia in 2010, 2011, because what Turkey was doing up until this period of time was kind of reshaking its own identity, its thinking. The speaker this afternoon talked about neo-Ottoman in a negative sense. As someone who's writing a book and focused on this idea of imperial legacies, I don't like the term neo-Ottoman either, because you can't recreate something of the past, but you can certainly reimagine the past and use that understanding to give you a new sense of urgency and responsibility. And I think that's what's been going on in Turkey, of saying, look, we're not a completely isolated country that can only look to the West. We need to actually think about our neighborhood and think about where we can be most effective. And the AKP was doing this in a very quiet way, but also in a very dramatic way. Visa-free travel and regimes with Syria, Iraq, they set up all these different organizations with their neighbors, and they focused almost exclusively on their neighbors. And so this idea in D.C. a lot of times that we have of the axis shift from west to east, I think is a little bit incorrect. It's more about neighborhood versus not neighborhood, right? And the neighborhood includes Christian countries, Balkan countries, Caucasian countries, and Middle Eastern countries. So to simply say this is about Muslim identity misses some of the larger nuances here. But I do think that there is something particular about the Anatolian mindset of a conservative Muslim as they look towards this region of the world and say, look, the Kemalists for so long have only focused on the West and the European Union that we want to focus on our immediate neighbors. We want to figure out how we can be helpful in Syria and Iran and Iraq and these areas. And of course, in 2010, this was made somewhat more easy in the sense that with the Mami Marmara incident, the Gaza flotilla, in which nine Turkish citizens, one who was a dual American citizen, were killed by Israeli forces, the prime minister's kind of street credentials. This is a prime minister that comes from one of the roughest neighborhoods of Istanbul, equivalent of Bronx, New York, maybe Southie in Boston, who has this kind of charisma that oozes. He doesn't speak very eloquently sometimes. He says things that don't exactly sound statesmanlike, but when he speaks, Turkish people listen. And whether you hate him or love him, he's someone that has that ability to kind of capitalize on the Turkish spirit. And he's emerged in a period of time in which his country has become one of the most popular inspirations in its region. And he himself is a leader. Polls have continued to show since 2009 onward that he's the most popular leader in the Arab world, above any other Arab leader, above Ahmadinejad, above Hezbollah leaders, etc. And so in many ways, when the incident with Israel happened, this was already on this trajectory, and it really just emphasized it and made this very clear distinction between Arab leaders that were afraid to criticize Israel, European and American leaders who tended to not say as nasty things, and Turkey, who's able to say, what you did was wrong, we expect an apology, until you give us an apology, we're not backing down, to really show the strength of the Turkish state. And of course, at the same time, Turkey was trying to be proactive and find a solution to the Iranian nuclear question with Brazil. And it was a very smart decision to work with a country like Brazil, another emerging power that is not on the United Nations Security Council, but demands a place at the table of world order, to say, look, the West has tried for so long, the Iranians don't trust you, let us try. And it was very significant. It was the first time that the Iranians had ever signed anything when it came to this. And it was a flawed document, for sure, but at the same time, this is exactly what the American president had asked the Turks to do. And so, the moment that this came out, the Americans disowned it, and the Turks felt very betrayed in this sense. To say, look, we did exactly what you asked us to, and now we're going back on it. So the Turks, in many ways, learned the hard lessons of geopolitics. And all this backdrop to say that when in 2011 that Tunisia erupted and then Egypt erupted, it was very easy for Turkey to get on the bandwagon early. Turkey was the first country to call for Mubarak to leave, not necessarily because they were on the right side of history, like many leaders continue to claim, but because they really didn't like Mubarak. Mubarak and Erdogan were not friends. And when you think about Egyptian foreign policy in this area of the world, Egypt and Turkey were on polar opposite sides. Anytime I traveled, whether it was to Syria, Jordan, anywhere, the Egyptian the press people would come immediately up to me and try to get me to say something nasty about Turkey. They would try to tell me that, Turkey's not wanted here. They're not Arab, so they shouldn't be involved in our politics. And of course, this type of animosity continued for a very long period of time. So when Prime Minister Erdogan called for Mubarak to leave and began to hold up the Tunisian people and the Egyptian people as our brothers, it was kind of a no-brainer. And so the entire world began to look to Turkey to say, look, here's a Muslim-majority nation that has gotten Islam and democracy right, for whatever that means. Why can't we use the Turkish model? Now, of course, the Turkish model was a very attractive one, but Turkey has spent 90 years struggling with its own history. Turkey didn't emerge out of a vacuum. It has a very strong state tradition. It comes out of the legacy of the Ottoman Empire, something that none of these other Arab states can claim. And so while Turkey certainly has some points to offer, I could argue on two different sides here. One Turkish model is to have a strong military, to impose changes from the top, including the founder of the republic, to kind of force the Turkish population to emerge into modernity. Or you could say it's more about the transition into a more economic power and using soft power, a la Turka power, using Turkish power, which means the power of soap operas, the power of economic entrepreneurship. It's unlocking the spirit of the Turks into this region of the world. You could argue on both of these. Now, of course, Tunisia and Egypt by themselves would have been great foreign policy successes, but then came Libya and Syria. And on Libya, Turkey sounded outright Russian at first, where basically it said, we don't think any NATO forces, no Western forces should be involved here. And it was more about a competition in many ways, right? Even after Turkey had joined the Western alliance against Gaddafi, who had given an award to Prime Minister Erdogan, at that point in time, there was competition emerging between France and Turkey that have always had differences in their past, and also because in many ways they're natural rivals, having been former empires in the same region of the world. And so when the President of France and the Prime Minister of Britain went to Libya, they went 2 days before the Turkish Prime Minister, and the Turkish Prime Minister, rather than kind of letting it roll off his back, chose to make fun of them and said, look, these guys came to visit Tripoli. They got stuck in their security entourages. Did they say any part of real Libya? Look at me. I visited four provinces. I got to visit all the people. I'm a man of the Libyan people, and I'm going to go pray with these people on a Friday. And then the very next day, he was in Egypt, and he decided to give a speech about secularism to the Muslim Brotherhood, that while they had greeted him with open arms with Turkish flags at the airport at 2 a.m, which is suspicious given that they had Turkish flags. Where do you buy these types of things? We can go into where these types of things. All I'm simply trying to point out is, in many ways, this was more about domestic politics than foreign policy. And as a result, when he returned, he was seen as the great kind of, savior of this Arab Spring world. And he took it one step further. He decided to go to Somalia as his next step and to lecture the West at the United Nations about having forgotten about the trials of Somalia. This is clearly a man on a mission. This is clearly a country with a mission of being able to show that Turkey has a new model of development, a new way of showing its power. It's not in the typical sense of using military might. It's not about invading Syria. It's not about forcing Assad to do anything. It's about using the power of persuasion. Now, in Syria in particular, this has been very frustrating for the Turks because they stood by President Assad all the way up until the fall, until basically they realized that they were getting nowhere. And particularly the sensibilities of the AKP were distraught when in Ramadan, the month that you're supposed to be fasting and focusing on your relationship with God, this president continued to kill his own citizens in a horrific manner. So as a result, the Turks changed their rhetoric and began to be very critical, but at the same time, we're not doing as much as many powers had wanted them to do. And now Turkey, that had so long, for 10 years, asked for responsibility, had demanded they be at the seat of international leadership, was being given leadership, and the West became frustrated because Turkey was not doing as much as they thought, precisely because Syria was such a big problem. In many ways, Turkey fears that a civil war in Syria, chaos in Syria, is far worse than a dictatorial regime. And the much vaunted language of zero problems with neighbors has unfortunately become zero neighbors without problems. And I think when you look at Iraq, where the prime minister has been very critical of the sectarian violence that he says Turkey is perpetuating. When you look at Iran, its sudden change in policies because of Turkey's NATO membership of keeping radar sites on its territory, it shows you how difficult the Middle East is. And the reason Turkey for so long was able to stay above this was because they stuck to business. They let their entrepreneurs do their speaking for them. There were state policies when the prime minister or the president visits any country in the region. He takes far more economists and far more businessmen than he does journalists, because in many ways, that's what's important. And so when he goes to open schools and hospitals all around the Middle East and throughout Central Asia and throughout Africa, this was the focus. But the difficulties of the Middle East in terms of this major difference between the Maghreb, where you saw the successful example of Tunisia, and you had people like Ghanoushi who used Turkey and used it explicitly, say, we want to be just like Turkey. That's who we want to be when we grow up one day. And the Turks reveled in this, to be able to say, look, they want to be us. We're not saying we're a model. We're just an inspiration. These guys want to be us. If they want to do that, what can we do? This became problematic in a lot of different ways between that and what was happening in its immediate neighborhood. Because in its immediate neighborhood, Turkey's hard power, its military, the second largest military in NATO, was feared, because what if they decide to turn on the regimes? It's easy to have zero problems when there's one regime in play. But what happens when the regime is at war with its people? You have to choose one or the other. And Turkey found this incredibly difficult. And I think what's happening today in Turkey in many ways can be interpreted through the lens of domestic politics, precisely because of the fact that every day in Turkey in the newspapers there's an open debate about saying, look, it's great that we got really irritated at the Israelis because of the Mami Marmara incident, but where's the Syrian flotilla? Where is the opportunity to reach out to our Syrian brothers who are being brutally demonized and being attacked by the Syrian regime? We have an army strong enough to defeat these guys. If we would just put our rhetoric and put our actions where our mouth is, this is the way we do leadership. And I think one of the challenges that Turkey is discovering is, for as much criticism as there has been about the European Union process that is pretty much at a dead standstill, and as much criticism as Turkey has given the West, Turkey's facing the exact same criticism that they launched on the West, precisely from this region of the world. And so Arabs are now beginning to take a second look at Turkey and say, look, you know, it's fine to have nice words to us, but what are you actually doing? And I think the challenge here is the Turkish population, the Turkish people in many ways are very active and very hopeful of certain areas, but their leadership is very scared because of the domestic changes that have gone on in Turkey in terms of the lack of a constitution that continues to be a constitution written by the military in the 1980s. Turkey of today, in terms of what it represents on the international level, is not modeled by what we see on the domestic level. And the prime minister, who's been a phenomenal leader in Turkey that has gone for 10 years, as people begin to question his health and what will happen when he becomes president, we're looking at a post-Erdogan world, and it's a scary world. Because if there's no Erdogan in Turkey, what happens to Turkey? It looks like there'll be a fractured AKP. No one has the charisma. No one has the power to hold this together. And when you think about what's happening today in the foreign policy community in 2011, we've never seen the U.S. and Turkey as close as they are today. But I would argue that's more of a historical anomaly in terms of a coincidence than any type of structural policy adjustments made on the American or the Turkish side. When the Syrian uprising began, when the Arab Spring began, when the European fall began, when you saw Greece and Italy go into chaos, Turkey was the natural winner, not because they had great policy, but because they were the only ones that had their economy growing so quickly. And unfortunately, there's a tendency both within Turkey and a lot of Mediterranean countries to be hyperbolic, to say the world is either falling or we're the king of the world. And so you go from one extreme of saying no one loves us to everyone loves us, don't you dare criticize us. And I think this type of oscillation between one extreme to the other is particularly difficult, and it's difficult even for a country like the United States that is so desperate to keep Turkey as a strategic ally that even friends are not willing to speak the truth to power sometimes. And then as a result, having those discussions, those difficult discussions about what we need to do as a transatlantic community to focus on Turkey's European membership at the same time we talk about Turkey's rightful role in the Middle East, it shouldn't be an either-or discussion. The Ottoman Empire had been Janus face for its entire history, where it was able to be both a European power and a Middle Eastern power. And Turkey, in many ways, is this supra-regional power, where it can be all of the above. There's no need to choose A, B, or C. It's D, all the above. And that type of mentality, that changing of the Cold War mindset, is something that we're working very difficultly on in the United States, particularly in European countries like France that tend to have certain biases against the Turkish people. But I think in a larger sense, it's something that Turkey also has to struggle with. They've been able to break out of the mold. They've been able to break out and to show what they're capable of. But now the question becomes, how are you going to be able to do that with and as opposed to against the West? Because Turkey, in many ways, the way it's risen so quickly has been precisely because many people are jealous and look at Turkey and say, look, they're both a European power. They're able to be in NATO, all these other institutions. If Turkey decides to basically say, to heck with Europe, we don't want it, we want to go our own way, Turkey becomes nothing more than just another Middle Eastern power that is anti-Western. And that, in many ways, is precisely the danger that there is in Turkey when you have a populist movement that is able to capture the street feeling. And so being able to have leaders that shape popular feelings, and looking at the EU statistics, it's very telling. You know, 5 years ago, everyone was in support of Turkish membership. Today, the EU minister wants to change the title of his ministry because he feels like he has nothing to do these days in terms of complaining to the European Union and demanding that they open new chapters. There's very little constructive dialogue happening, and I think in many ways, this is where the United States, this is where Turkey in many ways needs to work with its partners in the world to show that its geostrategic value, which has always been important, is only able to match up to its soft power in its region, and to not overstep those bounds that it has in terms of being able to be a major player, but to not have to be the only player. So I'll end right there and let Omar pick up where I left off, but I'll stop there. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Professor Omar Tashbinar, who teaches national security strategy at the U.S. National War College. He's also the director of the Turkey Project at the Brookings Institution. He is an adjunct professor of European Studies and the Middle East at Johns Hopkins University. And let me say that Professor Tashbinar is the author of Political Islam and the Kurdish Nationalism in Turkey, as well as Fighting Radicalism with Human Development. He received his PhD and MA from Johns Hopkins University and BA from the Technical University in Ankara. Professor Tashbinar.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. Many thanks to the organizers. I think Joshua Workle has covered a lot in a very fast way. So I'm left with basically the question of filling the blanks in terms of what is this Turkish model? What is its relevance for the Arab world? I guess the good news, when you come from Washington, you focus, as Josh mentioned, on geopolitics and the narrative in Washington about Turkey. And the good news about the narrative in Washington about Turkey is that for the last few years, there has been a sense of pessimism about losing Turkey in Washington. Turkey was perceived, starting with the invasion of Iraq, the Turkish no to the use of Turkish territories for American troops, and then Turkey's growing relations with the Islamic world, especially Turkey's strong sense on the Palestinian issue, the visit of Hamas leader Khalid Meshal in 2006, and then the sense that Turkey was very close to Iran and Syria. Remember, this zero problems with neighbors policy was partly because Turkey decided that it should engage Syria and Iran. And when you want to pursue zero problems with Iran and Syria, it is impossible to have zero problems with Washington, D.C. You're bound to have some problems with Washington. And there was this perception of Turkey turning its back to NATO. There was a perception that Turkey was becoming increasingly anti-American, and that there was a rise of Islam in Turkey, that Turkey was becoming increasingly Islamized. This was especially very common among the neoconservative circles during the Bush administration, that there was this rise of political Islam in Turkey. AKP was portrayed as an Islamist party. When they wanted to be really nice, they would say moderately Islamic, but it was perceived as an Islamist party. And then in 2010, with Obama, at the time when we hoped things would really improve, there came the crisis over Iran. As Joshua mentioned, when Turkey mediated the Tehran agreement about uranium enrichment, that came as a huge disappointment to Washington. A lot of people said that this was the wrong time, it was the wrong approach. The push in Washington was for sanctions against Iran, and Turkey is a NATO member and a member of the United Nations Security Council in 2010. Vetoed the sanctions, voted against sanctions, at the time when China and Russia voted for sanctions against Iran. And this created a big crisis with the Obama administration in terms of Turkey, in terms of the Iran policy of the Obama administration. So as late as 2010, there was this certain level of pessimism about where Turkey was going. Popular columnists like Tom Friedman in the New York Times wrote about Turkey being part of an Islamist axis, being closer to Iran, Syria, Hamas, the Palestinians, and having huge problems now with Israel after the Mavi Marmara incident, and having huge problems with the United States. So there was a lot of gloom and doom in this perception of Turkey, as late as 2010. Then look at today. Joshua rightly mentioned this is the golden age of Turkish-American relations. We're in a honeymoon with the United States. So what has changed in the last year and a half? From 2010, the summer of 2010, this whole pessimistic image of who lost Turkey? Why is Turkey turning Islamist? To today, Turkey as a model. We keep hearing, reading about this Turkish model. Well, the answer is partly the Arab Spring. From being an Islamist country that the West has lost, Turkey has moved to being the model for Egypt, the model for Tunisia. We now hope that all Muslim movements in the region, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Syria, will be lucky enough to be as moderate as the Justice and Development Party. We hope that they will be as lucky as to evolve along the lines of a Turkish model. Perhaps because the alternatives are much worse. What is the alternative to the Turkish model? Again, often the alternative is perceived as the Iranian revolution, where you had basically, again, a people's revolution. Iran, the revolution in 79, if you remember, you're much more qualified than I do, Professor, was a people's revolution hijacked by the clergy at the end of the day. So the fear is that, again, the Arab revolutions, the Arab awakening, may be hijacked by Islamists and may create Islamist regimes. And the fact that in Egypt you had the Muslim Brotherhood and then the Salafists winning a large majority created this sense of alarm. So when the alternative to the Turkish model of moderate Islam, although I don't like the term, that's what it's used, and perception is the reality, the alternative to this Turkish moderate, friendly, good Islam is the radical Islam of the Iranian revolution. Or maybe the influence coming from the Gulf, the Wahhabi Islam. And in this context, Turkey appears to be, of course, a much more positive influence on the region. And in that sense, the good news right now is that in Washington, no one talks about who lost Turkey. No one talks about the Islamization of Turkey. To the contrary, there is this hope that Turkey may teach some democratic lessons to the region, that Turkey may prove a useful model in terms of the compatibility of the regime with democracy and moderate Islam. And down the line, there is this hope that Turkey will play a much more positive role in the region. So the narrative has changed. So that's the good news. But with the focus on Turkey, since there is so much focus now on the Turkish model, there comes also deeper scrutiny. And although everyone agrees that overall Turkey's foreign policy influence has increased, now when you look at the media, when you look at the detailed analysis of what is going on inside Turkey, the Turkish debate, with this increasing scrutiny, there comes a realization that the model has problems. The model has essentially two problems. A problem with the Kurdish minority. What will happen to the Kurds? In fact, sometimes you hear about whether there will be a Kurdish spring as well in the region, and whether the Kurds will also, of Turkey for instance, push for their own nationalist movement, their own awakening, their own demands for, instance, decentralization, federation, stronger cultural rights. And this puts Turkey in defense, because the good things about the model, the moderate Islam question, somehow lose some of their significance when you focus on the ethnic problem of Turkey, the Kurdish problem. But more importantly, perhaps, is the factor of freedoms in Turkey, something that we heard this morning, freedoms related to freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of the press, and this big tension in Turkey, this big polarization in Turkey, focused on essentially civil-military relations to a certain degree, but more importantly on where Turkey is going, whether Turkey can really become a liberal democracy. Because if Turkey is not a liberal democracy, if it's not really a first-ranked liberal democracy, why should it be a model for the Arab world? Why should the Arab world not aspire to a better model than Turkey? And there is this fear in Turkey with a very powerful AKP now, which has won 3 elections in a row, and which shows strong reluctance to truly change the Turkish political system with a new constitution, which will tackle the Kurdish question. There is this fear that one type of authoritarianism in Turkey, the old type of Kemalist authoritarianism, is being replaced now by the authoritarianism of the AKP, or the authoritarianism of the Gülen movement sometimes, as it is being perceived. When you read the press now, there's increasing scrutiny of the Gülen movement as well, and the clash between the Gülen movement and the AKP is an interesting phenomenon for domestic Turkish politics, but it is also becoming increasingly scrutinized by the West in terms of what is the relationship of the Gülen movement to overall politics in Turkey, to democratization in Turkey, and what is the presence of, for instance, of Gülenists in the police force or the Gülenists in the judiciary in terms of this democratization debate. So these are polarizing issues for Turkey, and there's this fear that somehow there's a new type of authoritarianism emerging, and the secularists have now developed their own narrative of victimhood. We all have narratives of victimization in Turkey. The Gülen movement, the AKP, has a very strong narrative of victimhood. They were the victims during the Kemalist hegemony. Now the secularists feel that they are the victims, and they are developing a narrative of victimization against the hegemony of the AKP, and sometimes what they see, the hegemony of the Gülen movement, because they perceive the Gülen movement as behind the jailing of journalists because of the Gülen movement's influence in the judiciary or in the police force, for instance. So those are some of the new issues that are, I think, changing the debate in Washington about Turkey. It's no longer about Islamization. It's no longer Islam versus secularism. It's more about illiberal democracy, authoritarian democracy, majoritarian democracy versus liberal democracy. Democracy with minority rights, pluralist democracy, democracy with full freedoms. So this is a new debate. It's a more sophisticated debate about Turkey. And I welcome this debate as an analyst because that's what we need to talk about. The next step for Turkey is to focus on establishing a liberal democracy and this, to basically sideline this issue about Islam and secularism, this identity politics issue, and to focus on concrete issues regarding freedoms and to debunk this emerging image of Turkey as where one type of authoritarianism is being replaced by another type of authoritarianism. And this is difficult to achieve. Difficult to achieve for Turkey because democratization, the drivers of democratization traditionally has been in Turkey the European Union process, a sense that basically AKP needed the EU, the European Union, and now the EU, the European Union, is out of question, it's out of relevance in Turkey. And I will come back to this point in discussing the model of Turkey. So I just wanted to give you a kind of domestic implications of this Arab Spring for Turkey. The Kurdish question now is being more debated in the Western media as a problem of the Turkish model. Turkey's authoritarian leanings is being debated in more detail because Turkey is relevant. And the Gülen movement will increasingly be relevant because the Gülen movement is the most important religious movement of Turkey. And it is becoming increasingly scrutinized by the West. So we need to analyze these issues, and we have to be prepared to such scrutiny. And this is a new level of sophistication that the West is gaining about Turkey. In addition to the model debate, then at more concrete and geopolitical level, you have the influence of Turkey in the region, the foreign policy dimension. And I think here we have to look at, I will come back to the debate about the model, but let me just focus on the influence of Turkey in the region, which is not really about these issues regarding democracy or the Kurdish question, but what can Turkey do beyond being a model? Because being a model is fine, okay, but it's not really a very concrete term. I mean, when you go to Egypt and you say Turkey is a model, well, Egyptians would say, fine, okay, but what does it mean? Because no country is really a model for another. Every country is sui generis. So the impact of Turkey is important. And the impact, I think, comes in two senses. There is first the image of Turkey, about how did Turkey become Turkey? How did, for instance, a party like AKP has emerged in Turkey? And this model business is like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. If you're the Egyptian military, your model of Turkish development is not really moderate Islam. If you're the Egyptian military, you ask a simple question. Why is the AKP such a moderate party? Why is the AKP different than Erbakan, than Milli Görüş? What has changed Milli Görüş into conservative democracy, which is the slogan of AKP? And the Egyptian military says, well, it's the Turkish military. It's the red lines of Turkish secularism and the 28 February process, the postmodern coup, that has actually established such moderation. So for a range of people in power, especially in Egypt, the model is the role of the Turkish military. So that's one complicating factor about what is the model exactly. It's not just moderate Islam, but it's how you get to moderate Islam. And maybe the military played a role in that moderation. So that's one element. The second element is, what is Turkey's role in general in this region? And here we have the Shiite-Sunni divide in the Middle East. Is Turkey a Sunni power, or is Turkey a country that is transcending this Sunni-Shiite business? And especially for the Gulf region, for Saudis, this is a very important question, but also for Egypt. There's this concern about Iran and the nuclear weapon. And here, the concrete level of Turkish influence is important. Then for the United States, the impact of Turkey is not really about the model, but what can Turkey do in the context of crisis in the Middle East? And the most important crisis in the Middle East today, the urgent issue, is Syria. So what is the relevance of Turkey in the context of the Arab awakening, and more specifically about Syria? Fine, Turkey played an important role in the context of Egypt. It called for the end of the Mubarak regime. That was a bold move from the part of the prime minister. That's fine. In Tunisia, it was supportive of the democracy movement. That's fine too. But here is a crisis on Turkey's border. And the US tendency is to look at Turkey and say, well, Turkey is a powerful country. It's the regional superpower. For all the things that Joshua mentioned, there's a very strong image of Turkey and an economic, as an economic power, as a diplomatic power, as a military power. And Turkey is becoming the victim of its own success, of its own discourse about itself. Because remember what the Turkish leaders have been saying for a very long time. They've been calling for regional solutions to regional problems. Regional solutions to regional problems. Turkey is a center country. Turkey has a lot of influence. Nothing good happens in this region without Turkey being involved. That's the narrative you've been hearing from Ankara. A very strong, self-confident narrative. Well, if you're the superpower in Washington, you say, okay, here is the test. Here is a crisis in your region, Syria. Show us your influence. Tell us what you can do. And in Washington, there's often this focus on Turkey as a country that can really have influence over Syria. So people were expecting miracles from Turkey in the context of Syria. And whenever Turks are being asked about their strategy vis-a-vis Syria, other than calling for the end of the Assad regime, their answer is, what is the American strategy? What is the international strategy? What is the United Nations strategy? Well, you were calling for regional solutions to regional problems, so you're the regional superpower. Why don't you basically show more influence here? And then the Turkish answer is, no, we don't want to get involved without international legitimacy, without the US showing a sense of strategic direction. So you see here that basically there are limits to this Turkish influence. Turkey discovered, in my opinion, especially with Syria, the limits of its influence in the region. Because Syria was the crown jewel of the zero problems with neighbors policy. And once Syria, in terms of this being a zero problem neighbor, collapsed into a major problem country, Turkey is now struggling to find the way out. And there is no easy way out. Turkey doesn't want to intervene militarily. Turkey doesn't want to stay totally passive. So we're talking about conferences. We're talking about yet another Friends of Syria conference. We're talking about mediation. We're talking about finding a diplomatic solution, knowing full well that Bashar Assad may stay in power for a much longer time. And Turkey is facing this impasse. So again, it's fine to talk about the model. It's great to emphasize Turkey's growing importance in the region. But when push comes to shove, we need to figure out what is the concrete influence, what is the most important dimension that Turkey can bring to the table. And in the context of Syria, we see a lot of prudence coming from Turkey. And Turkey's reflex is overall trying to be very cautious, non-involvement, and international legitimacy. United Nations Security Council, we need to consult with Russia. It would be great if there is Russian-Chinese involvement. We don't want a war with Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Syria. And if you enter Syria, if you get involved in Syria, Syria may use the Kurdish card. Again, Turkey's soft belly, the Achilles heel of Turkey is the Kurdish question. Iran may also get involved with the Kurdish question. So there's a lot of realpolitik once you get one level beyond this narrative of Turkey as a model or influence of Turkey. You see that the Kurdish problem remains a very important issue. You see that basically Turkey's leverage in terms of solving the problems in the region, in terms of providing these regional solutions to regional problems, is limited. But to be fair, this is a big crisis, and not even the United States, not even NATO, not even the Arab League is able to offer concrete solutions. But there was this expectation that somehow Turkey had this huge leverage with Syria. Well, the answer is no. Turkey does not have this leverage with Bashar Assad, and the Prime Minister's reaction is partly because of that, because he thought that he had leverage with Bashar Assad. He thought that this was his basically young brother, that he had this father approach to him, that he was teaching certain things to him, and now he feels betrayed. And Prime Minister, as you all know, is a very emotional man, so what is happening in Syria, in a way, it's personal for him. And as Josh mentioned, the fact that the killings continued during the month of Ramadan has also created this kind of anger in Turkey. And let's not forget, Turkey is a Sunni country. And there is this growing perception of Syria as an Alevite regime killing Sunnis. So there's a sectarian dimension to this, which is very troubling. And that's another dimension. Okay, I will conclude by saying why Turkey is a different model, why Turkey is a different country than basically most of the countries we're talking about in the context of the Arab Spring, by trying to bring some realism or some reality check to this Turkish model concept. I've been writing about the Turkish model for a long time. I think that Turkey has, of course, a role to play. It's interesting to look at the Turkish example. But for five reasons, I also think that Turkey is very different than the rest of the Middle East. Let me enumerate these five reasons, and then we can revisit them, if you wish, in the Q&A. First of all, Turkey has an imperial legacy. Turkey comes from a state tradition, from an Ottoman state tradition, which itself has very strong roots in Central Asia, in the Mongolian, Persian, Byzantine state traditions. So the state in Turkey did not need Islam to be formed, whereas Arab states are much more at the mercy of Islam in terms of establishing themselves. There was no real Arab state before Islam. Islam has created the Arab state, whereas the Turkish state tradition, the Ottoman state tradition, owes basically nothing to religion. Religion is there for societal harmony, but there is a raison d'etat. There is a tradition of dominating Islam in the Turkic state tradition that does not have really an Arab equivalent. In that sense, Turkey is a country that has adopted this radical secularism for a reason. There was a sense that basically Turkey was able to establish that kind of secularism because it had a very strict state tradition. And that's a historical difference. And it goes back to the role of the military, it goes back to the role of the bureaucracy, but Islam was not really the creator of the Turkish state. That's one historical factor that needs to be, I think, taken into consideration. But it's not really thanks to the state's role or the imperial tradition of Turkey that Turkey was able to, in a way, dominate the Islamic realm, or basically was able to create a more moderate Islam, so to speak. It's also the second factor that differs Turkey. It's also because Turkey has become a democracy much earlier than most of these countries. It became a democracy, albeit a flawed one with military interventions, an illiberal one, in 1946. Starting with 1946, there has been elections. And even before that, during the Ottoman times, Turkey had its first constitution in the mid-19th century. So there's a history of multi-party politics. There's a history of political participation, which does not have really an Arab precedent. And in the presence of multi-party politics, Islam changed its role in Turkey. Islam was no longer just the only opposition movement, but it was one of the opposition movements. The mosques were not the only place where people would gather for opposing the government, like it was the case in the context of Egypt, for instance, or Iran or Algeria. But Islam was basically was part of the conservative political realm, and there were ideological, political rivalries, competitions in Turkey. Whereas in the Arab world, very often you have this dichotomy. You have the autocrats and you have the Islamists. Nothing in between and no elections and not really a liberal, not really democratic participation. And in the absence of democratic politics, what you had in Egypt, what you had in the Middle East overall was the Islamization of dissent. Islam becoming the only dissent movement, the only opposition movement, and the politicization of Islam, as the mosques were becoming increasingly political institutions. Turkey avoided that dilemma thanks to its democratization. And Islamists had a chance actually to come to power. And once they came to power, the slogan of Islam is the solution, which is the Muslim Brotherhood slogan in Egypt, was no longer relevant. Try to run a city like Istanbul with 15 million people with a slogan like Islam is the solution. You can't. Try to run a city like Cairo, 20 million people, with Islam is the solution as a slogan. No. If a Muslim Brotherhood mayor was able to become the mayor of Cairo, as Erdogan was able to become the mayor of Istanbul in 1994, I'm sure the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt would have evolved. They would have either become more pragmatic, more competent, or they would have been discredited. And this would have created the kind of demystification of Islam as a force that can solve all the problems. In Turkey, these dynamics started with the 1940s, 50s, and eventually with the arrival of an Islamic party to power, which has gained accountability, became more pragmatic, became more competent. Those are the dynamics that differ Turkey, that differs the Muslim Brotherhood from AKP. But for that, you need to have basically the different historical context. So that's the second factor. The first one, the state tradition. The second one, early democratization. The third factor is something that Ahmet Kuru mentioned today. Turkey is blessed by the absence of oil. Oil is a curse to your economy. When you don't have oil, you have to actually invest in your people, you have to invest in your economy, and you have to create a productive economy. You have to create a taxation-based system. You cannot just rely on a God-given natural resource and not tax your people. Turkey grew through taxation. Turkey grew to the emergence of a business community, the so-called Anatolian Tigers. So the absence of oil and the absence of reliance solely on strategic rent. Egypt does not have oil, but Egypt has strategic rent. It has the Suez Canal, it has the remittances coming from workers, it has vicinity to oil thanks to the geostrategic position, and it had all these workers in the Gulf who were sending substantial remittances. So it had basically a source of income independent of economic productivity. That's called strategic rent. And foreign aid was the strategic rent. Foreign aid to Egyptian economy played a major role. Well, Turkey managed to avoid the oil trap and managed to avoid the strategic rent trap by establishing a productive capitalist economy, an export-led economy. Malaysia, Indonesia are similar examples of growth. There is no other example of such export-led growth in the Middle East. So when you look at a more structuralist analysis of the Middle East, you see that Turkey is different, not because of this moderate Islam business or just state tradition or democracy, but because of its economy. You can have a basically structuralist analysis and look at how the Turkish bourgeoisie, the Turkish business community, and the emergence of a middle class changed Turkey. So that's the third factor. The fourth factor is the Sufi movement of Turkey. Turkey has a very strong Sufi movement, including the Gulen movement. And here I have my worries about the Sufi movement remaining Sufi, remaining unpolitical. Because to me, what makes the Sufi movement really powerful is this mystical approach and the approach to culture, education, social issues, rather than politicization of Islam. And the Gulen movement, up until recently, was able to stay above or an equal distance to political movements. Whereas now there is a perception that the AKP is the Gulen movement is becoming a political movement, out of essentially a sense of defense against the military. The fear of basically a military coup, the fear that the military would attack, would basically target the Gulen movement, has created this kind of defensive identity within the Gulen movement, which has turned into offense. They decided that in order to survive in Turkey, they have to go after the military. They have to go after the deep state. And this is the struggle we're facing today. The military did a stupid mistake in 2007 with the e-memorandum that unified, in a way, the AKP and the Gulen movement. The Gulen movement and AKP became one since 2007, and it has been a good thing for the AKP because it received a lot of support from the Gulen movement. Whereas now, I think we see the beginning of a fracture between the AKP and the Gulen movement, which is a very interesting phenomenon. What the military has not been able to achieve, which is to divide the AKP and the Gulen movement, it's the post-Kemalist order that is achieving now. A sense that basically there are different priorities, but the Gulen movement is very insecure. There's a very strong narrative of victimhood within the Gulen movement, and it wants to go after the deep state on the grounds that if it doesn't go after the deep state will go after the Gulen movement and will try to destroy it. All these things are politicizing Turkey's Sufi identity, in my opinion, because the Gulen movement is at the heart of Turkey's, in my opinion, the Sufi identity of Turkey. But with that parenthesis, I think the Sufi identity of Turkey is also something that differs Turkey from Egypt. Egypt does not have something similar to the Gulen movement or any other Arab country. So, but I would put the Sufi dimension of Turkey as something important that we should keep. We should have a movement like the Gulen movement, but it should try to stay above and beyond an equal distance to politics. I'm not sure if it's too late for that, but hopefully we can revisit that also in the Q&A. The fifth reason why Turkey is different than the Middle East is the European Union process. Without the EU, we would not have had a democratization process which would have united the Islamists, the Kurds, the secularists, the liberal democrats. Everyone was united behind the EU in the good old days when the EU was relevant. In 2004, 2005, the EU was very relevant. Now the EU is no longer relevant. But imagine if there was an EU process for Morocco, if there was an EU process for Algeria, for Egypt. That would also create a sense of coalition among the democrats in these countries. Turkey had the luxury of having this kind of movement, a pro-EU movement for democratization. This is absent in the context of the Middle East, so there's no anchor for democratization that Turkey benefited from, Central Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, the Balkans have benefited from. There's no external anchor that can provide momentum for democratization. Without the European Union, I don't think Turkey would have established the level of democracy that it has established today, the kind of civilian supremacy over the military that we're talking about. I went already too long, but I wanted to emphasize all these points. I'll be happy to answer questions later.
I want to thank our two speakers for giving really two excellent and very complementary presentations, focusing on very different issues. If I may, I'd like to just make two very brief comments. One, again, if I may, has to do with the economy. You mentioned it as one of your five characteristics that make Turkey unique. But I wonder to what extent, if you will, not real politique, but real economique, has played a role in in Turkish foreign policy in the region, given the very strong thrust of the entrepreneurial activities and the rise of the bourgeoisie and the clear need for markets in the region, particularly vis-a-vis Iraq, for example, but other countries in the region as well. That was implicit in your comments, but again, if you would be willing to comment very briefly so we could get to the questions. The other, I think, has to do with again, this notion of Turkey being a model for the region, a democratic model. The model has been, by and large, a passive one, I think, as you have mentioned. So quite aside from the way that you presented the question, that here you are, a superpower in the region, now do something, right? Well, but aside from that, here you are a democratic Islamic, well, democratic, let's say, government, and throw your support behind democratic movements. I think, as both of you indicated, Turkey has been somewhat reluctant in this manner. Let me mention another example of that reluctance. I remember when Ahmadinejad was elected, Turkey was the second, if not the first, country to congratulate him, which was absolutely astounding, given the fact what was going on the streets of Tehran and the full awareness on the part of the Turkish government about the very contentious nature of that election. One might have thought that the great bastion of, you know, Islamic democracy in the region would be at least more measured, you know, in this manner. What could explain that kind of enthusiasm for Ahmadinejad at the time that it occurred?
So can I just try to answer your points very quickly? Yeah. Your two points are interconnected. The economy explains to a certain degree why Turkey wants stability in the region. Turkey is a status quo-oriented country. It doesn't want really regime changes or revolutionary changes in the region, essentially because it's fear of the Kurdish problem. When you talk about self-determination in the Middle East, people's movements, there's this fear that down the line this may impact the Kurdish question as well. But it is also a country that is a very strong economy, and for the strong economy to function well, you need to have markets. Some people call Turkey the merchant state, mercantilism, as the main driver of Turkish foreign policy. There is an element of truth to that. Why do you think Turkey was so reluctant to get involved in Libya or to get NATO involved in Libya? Because there were commercial interests in Libya with the Gaddafi government. Turkey had basically construction companies that were owed something along the lines of $15 billion. And if Gaddafi is gone, if you basically wage war in Libya, if you destabilize Libya, what would happen to this money that is owed to Turkish companies? So there is a certain status quo-oriented, stability-oriented approach that comes with being dependent on the status quo, stability in the region. It is absolutely shameful that Abdullah Gül was the second or first president to call Ahmadinejad after the elections in Iran. And Turkey's insensitivity to the Green Movement was also shameful. Because what was the difference between the Green Movement in the streets of Tehran and the Tahrir Square? Not much. But Turkey basically ignored the Green Movement and congratulated Ahmadinejad. But with the Tahrir Square, it went basically for full support. Well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that Turkey does not want to rock the boat with the government of Iran, because it is dependent on Iran on a number of issues. 85% of Turkish economy depends on gas, natural gas and oil coming from two countries, Russia and Iran. So if you rock the boat with Iran, that may have an impact on your economy. There is a lot of trade with Iran. But more importantly, Iran also holds the Kurdish card. Iran can also destabilize Turkey by using the PKK card. So there are all these factors that actually creates tension between Turkey's hope of seeing democracy in the region, this whole business about Turkey as a model, etc., and actually Turkey's invested interest in stability as a merchant country, as a capitalist country, for these markets. This creates a tension in Turkey between realpolitik and the ideals of democratization.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I would just echo a few things, but highlight them in perhaps a little bit different way. I think the other point here is, it's exactly what Omar and I are both referencing. When you set out principles that are supposed to be universalistic, then when suddenly the reality is, you know, there's a conflict there, then you have to make a choice. And it doesn't make any sense to criticize Israel so harshly for its policies on being oppressive and apartheid state, making nasty comments about free speech in France, and yet people point to your own country and say, wait a minute, what about you guys? You have the most number of journalists in jail. You called Ahmadinejad first. And I would echo, you know, kind of Omar's point here. I wouldn't put as much, I definitely think that the economy is a factor on the Iran one, but I think the geopolitical game with Iran is a much bigger factor. Turkey desperately wants to be the solution. They want to be the bridge between Iran and America. Of course, the Iranians nor the Americans really want to solve their issues through Turkey. I mean, I think Americans are more willing to use Turkey than the Iranians, but the Iranians, at the end of the day, have a regime that have been in place that basically has built its own legitimacy on anti-American rhetoric. So Turkey being this kind of soft model, I mean, I think that Turkey's been very disappointed. And in the last year, the rhetoric out of Tehran against Ankara has been unbelievable. You know, the moment that, you know, Turkey began to kind of build these radar sites and decided to go more in line with the transatlantic community over the last year because of the Arab Spring, in many ways there's a proxy war going on in the region now. The Sunni-Shia divide that Omar is talking about is not just between the Saudi Arabians that despise the Turks and the Turks who reciprocate, but it's also with the Iranians who are like in many ways fighting for their last bastion in Syria. Because as Hezbollah and other groups have begun to try to figure out new ways of dealing with the crisis that's going on in Syria that's prevented the arms to go through, Turkey is trying to find a way of saying, look, we don't want to get into direct conflict. I mean, there is a need in some ways to be loved in Turkey, wanting to please everybody at once. And like Omar rightly said, if you're going to be on the side of Iran or Syria in terms of Assad and Ahmadinejad or Khomeini regime, there's a major problem here. And I think that one of the points that you pointed at, if I can just do a small advertisement, I think my co-author Nader Habibi is here, who's an economist, and we looked at this idea of kind of Turkey's role in the Middle East. And you're absolutely right. The real economy is directly what the Turkish version of realpolitik. And the difference here is when you look at the absolute value of how the Turkish trade in the Middle East has been going, it's been on an upward trajectory. It's not as significant, right? It's not 50% like the EU is and was, but it's growing at an exponentially faster rate. And so the real question now is, this Arab Spring has messed that up. Right? The Arab Spring has suddenly thrown the entire region into instability, and the Turks are basically trying to figure out a way to secure their business interests in certain areas of the world, and particularly in the Middle East, while at the same time retaining the flow of information. And in many ways, they're kind of saying, look, the Iranians are causing major trouble here. Stop the rhetoric on Israel. Stop the rhetoric about a war between these two countries. And Turkey is caught in the middle, because any instability will hurt the Turkish economy more than anybody else. And it's already, the European market has already become very unstable for Turkey. The last thing they really want is for the entire neighborhood, in terms of the Gulf states and in terms of a war between Israel and Iran, what that would mean. So you're absolutely right.
Excellent. Okay. Would you kindly introduce yourself, I mean, say your names and then ask your questions, if possible, briefly. Thank you.
My name is Ugay Erkan.
Yes.
Just wonder, Iran and Turkey are rivals, so they do a dance of threat and congratulations, and so that things don't get worse. But that's not my question. One of the speakers was saying that Turkish economy was very good because exports was very high. But on the other hand, what happens if you import more than export? Does this affect the GDP positively or negatively?
Very short. We have a current account deficit problem, which is slowing down because Turkish economy is actually slowing down. But overall, the point that I was trying to make is that Turkey, compared to the Middle East, is an export-led economy and manufacturing sector, taxation-based.
No, in America or in Turkey, the net export counts. It's both negative effects GDP. Okay. Now, I have not been in Turkey for a long time, but what is carrying Turkish economy is consumerism. Consumerism is 71% of American economy. So maybe, probably, from my hypothesis, I don't even know, that there is no savings. Borrowings that go 50% every year. So internal consumerism is causing an exploit explosion of in GDP.
Let's keep that as a comment. Yeah.
As you say, having more imports is very dangerous because you have to pay this, the difference. If you don't have dollars, who's going to pay this?
Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you for your very insightful presentation.
Your name?
My name is Katie Gifta. And you mentioned in your talk, I think this is something to both of you, the sort of authoritarian style of the Prime Minister, the jailing of journalists. And I was wondering what your take is on the ongoing military trials, both the Agnew and the Bayo trials, as well as the jailing of a high number of journalists, although two, I think, four months in there. And to what extent you think this is a healthy process of democratization for Turkey, or whether it's the regime's way of showing some strength and silencing opposition?
I'll jump in real quick because, this is absolutely something that's mind-blowing. The foreign minister was just in Washington 3 weeks ago, and he got a few questions on this. And if you read the New Yorker article a couple of days ago with Erdogan, that's basically what you're referencing, their response is very similar. They're kind of like, hey, guys, look what else we've done in this region. Like, why are you bothering us? You know, journalists are not a big deal. These guys aren't really journalists. They're terrorists, right? These guys are not real journalists. And certainly, journalism, and I know Omer is a columnist for one of the Turkish newspapers, but I think he would probably agree. Journalism in Turkey does not have the right standards, absolutely. But that type of argument doesn't pass muster in the West, right? The bottom line is, okay, why is it that people are beginning to self-censor themselves? Why is it that it is clear that there's fabrication in the trials that are going on? I mean, I think I was one of the first people to write in the English language about Ergenekon and these trials, and I basically said, look, this is a good thing. I think it's a good thing for the deep state to be called to account and to be put on trial. But yet the problem is it's become a score-settling mechanism. And I think Omer said it well, and I want to hear him expand on it as well, that the split between the AKP and the Gulen movement can be seen very clearly. Right? Like, I'll point it out directly. Zaman newspaper has been more in touch with Ergenekon and the sledgehammer in these cases in many ways than it's been on almost any other topic. Right? Even at the time in which people were kind of scratching their heads saying, why are only these guys focusing on it? You know, to me, this is not a question of just about the AKP. This is about the internal schism of the broad tent of AKP leadership. Because many people I talk to within the government are very uncomfortable about this because they understand that this is something that the West values very, very strongly. It's very easy for Western journalists to point to their own and say, I knew this person. They're in jail. He's not a terrorist. He may be a nationalist. He may be anti-Erdogan. He may be anti-Gulen movement, but he doesn't deserve to be in jail. And I think that this type of rhetoric that the government is using, instead of explaining very clearly the problems that they have in their own coalition because they're trying to keep their own house in order, this is where it's going to become problematic. And this is why I fear that the kind of hegemonic structure that's been put in place is precisely what Omer referenced, right? He basically said you went from a Kemalist authoritarianism into something else. And what concerns me as well is the perceptions, which is, I agree, 100% reality. If the prime minister goes to become president and the president goes to become prime minister, we have a term for that. It's called Russia, right? And Turkey does not deserve to be like a Russia. The people of the country, the civil society of the country, the Gulen movement, everybody deserves better than that. And so being able to find a way in which the constitution has to be the priority here, because if you have the right constitution in place and you had the right rule of law that was a true independent judiciary and a true independent police force, etc., then you won't have some of these problems. And so these are all growing pains. And, you know, I certainly don't want to be the pessimist who says these are major problems, but you need to focus on that and not simply brush aside that and use this rhetoric of, well, it's always the West. When the Economist article criticizes us, when the Financial Times criticizes us, when the New York Times criticizes us, they use it in a populistic way and say, of course they're going to criticize us because they're scared of Turkish power and we are the Turkish people and we will rise against this type of anti-Western imperialism.
Briefly, would you like to add?
Yeah, I mean, the good news again is that the days of a military coup are over in Turkey. The military tutelage system has basically come to an end. However, the price to pay for this has been the jailing of, 15, 20% of active duty generals, the jailing of the former chief of staff. And there has been a silent revolution in Turkey in terms of civil-military relations. And that's a good thing. Turkey is becoming, in my opinion, as far as civil-military relations are concerned, a more democratic country. But the problem of liberal democracy is beyond that. The problem of liberal democracy is about freedoms, minority rights, about freedom of association, freedom of speech. And you have major issues on these areas, not because of the problem related to political Islam, secularism, civil-military relations. But now, for instance, AKP is in charge, but the Kurdish problem is arguably at a point where there is more polarization in the country. We're nowhere close to solving the Kurdish problem through enlarging freedoms. To the contrary, because of the arrests of journalists, Kurdish journalists, who are perceived as Kurdish militants because they have links to certain Kurdish organizations that are actually advocating, for instance, an agenda that is perceived as a terrorist agenda, we are unable in the Turkish constitution, in the Turkish system, to distinguish between what is freedom of speech and what is a violent movement that is determined to basically end the state or destroy the state. Everything that is critical of the unitary nature of the state becomes into a kind of terrorist, is perceived as a kind of potentially terrorist movement. So here we need, of course, constitutional change. And the AKP has been reluctant to go after that because it's not really perceived as a vote winner for the AKP. The Prime Minister has put on the brakes on this constitutional debate, and there is essentially no movement in terms of tackling issues that would transform Turkey from being a majoritarian democracy into a liberal democracy. And I already mentioned the issues regarding the Gulen movement and AKP in this question, but I think the Gulen movement feels very insecure vis-à-vis the military, because they don't think that the days of a military coup are over. They still think that there is a potential return of the deep state. They feel very insecure because, I think partly because of the mistakes that the military did. In the eyes of the military, the AKP was an Islamist movement, but they were out in the open. They were dealing with them. Whereas the Gulen movement was the real irtija, as they called it. The real irtija was the Gulen movement. They really wanted to go after the Gulen movement. And the Gulen movement, through its basically networks within the state, learned that. And they realized that this is an existential debate for them. If they don't go after the people who are about to destroy them, they will be destroyed. So this turned into a zero-sum game for the Gulen movement, whereas the AKP in power managed to cut deals or establish a modus vivendi with the military or the deep state to a certain degree, which the Gulen movement did not want to go, did not want to have. So now you have basically this threat perception of the Gulen movement that is different than the threat perception of AKP. And here we have a major fissure, a major crack in this so-called conservative pious coalition between the AKP and the Gulen movement. I don't know to what degree this will continue. I think the crisis over the intelligence agency MIT in Turkey is more or less solved, but we have definitely come to a new paradigm. We have reached a new paradigm in terms of civil-military relations and in terms of relations between the AKP and the Gulen community.
Thank you. Yes.
You were just talking about. I'm not totally clearly understanding how the Gulen movement was so engaged with the military in the state when the military was more oppressive, like really hostile against Islamists. And at that time, the leader Fethullah Gulen was talking pro-military. I interviewed him. He said, "The best time in my life was my military service." And there is a sense in the movement that they actually live for the state of the nation, and they appreciate their military power. And these things happened when the military was most repressive. So nowadays, the military's power in politics has been reduced because of the reforms, etc. And you're arguing now they're more threatened by the military. So that is a paradox to me. And in terms of the insecurity of the Gulen movement, this movement has been engaging to every host state they have been working in. I mean, they're all over the globe, very friendly with states, very cooperative even with Washington. Why would they be insecure? I mean, in terms of economics, too, this is an economic empire. They have so much money. So we have a big question about their insecurity and why they would turn insecure when they're so much more powerful now.
The short answer is that the threat perception does not go away. There is a narrative of victimhood, and there is a perception of threat that it's still there. But your point about AKP being pro-military, I think the issue during the 28 February process, for instance, the issue here is that the Gulen movement being pro-military, sorry, the Gulen movement always had a problem with Milli Görüş. Milli Görüş was political Islam, so to speak, and it had basically echoes of the Muslim Brotherhood, whereas the Gulen movement was Anatolian Islam. It had no problem, essentially, with the role of the state, Kemalism, Ataturk. It had this narrative of victimhood, but it did not want to challenge the secularist system. It believed in a social, cultural process of winning hearts and minds, whereas the AKP was the political instrument, the Milli Görüş was the political movement, and Fethullah Gülen himself was always in distance to Erbakan. So we should not interpret basically the distance between Milli Görüş and the Gülen movement as basically the Gülen movement being very pro-military. They had problems, but they basically had a different strategy to deal with the radical secularism of Turkey. It was through culture, social methods to education, whereas Milli Görüş was going for the political route. I think the military in 2007 realized that they can deal to a certain degree with AKP. But they have rightly come to understand that in their system of radical secularism, the Gulen movement is the most important threat. So their threat perception of officers, of the generals, etc., became the Gulen movement. They started naming Jemaat as the problem. And I think they wanted AKP to distance itself from the Jemaat. Which, and the opposite happened, because the Prime Minister, to his credit, decided to call for elections and did not really pursue a strategy of going after the Gulen movement. This is why after 2007 we had this unbelievable unity between the Gulen movement and AKP. Unprecedented level of unity, because the Gulen movement up until then was still trying to maintain a certain level of distance to politics. But once they felt that they were threatened to such degree by the military, they started to go after it. Now that you have the generals in jail, that now that the days of a military coup are over, you may expect that they would basically say, okay, mission accomplished, it's fine. And AKP wants them to say, mission accomplished, let's put on the brakes, let's basically see this. But they believe that the reason why the days of a military coup are over is because they have been going after the military. And they want the AKP to be fully supportive of that. But there is also the Kurdish question, on which they differ with the AKP to a certain degree. Because I think the Gulen movement, compared to the AKP, is more nationalist. The AKP is willing to consider a narrative of, we're all Muslim, why can't we get along? A more universal Islam approach to Kurdish problem. Whereas I think in the eyes of the Gulen movement, there is still this attachment to the idea of Turkish Islam, Turkishness, and an attempt to basically solve the Kurdish problem through social economic development, not to address the identity dimension. That's why now currently you have this big division in Turkey between the liberal democrats, who used to be very close to the Gulen movement, who now are distancing themselves from the Gulen movement because of the Gulen movement's position on the Kurdish question. And the Kurdish question is creating a divide between liberal democrats and the Gulen movement. Again, those are issues that are very difficult to grasp for a foreign audience, but I think they're at the heart of the power struggle in Turkey.
Thank you. Yes, bring it back. Yes.
Thank you for the excellent talk. Mr. Mahmoud, since you probably joining in slow motion. Very nice, thank you. I have two questions. So do you really believe that the days of coup are over without a new constitution? Let's say Erdogan is not here, do you think it's really over without Erdogan in place? And the second thing is Sufi movements becoming political. On that, both claims were always that for over 30 years, Islamists trying to infiltrate, take over, especially the Gulen movement. And both claims were quieter in the past years, but in the past couple of weeks, with the addition of WikiLeaks, Karabsky newspapers, articles, we started hearing it again. What changed?
I think the fact that you're asking the question of are the days of military coup over, do I really believe, is that to a certain degree you think that they're not. And I think that that's exactly the point. The Gulen movement doesn't think that the days of a military coup are over. What I think about it is that it's not just to Erdogan that the military has been undermined. Turkey is structurally changing. The fact that you have a middle class in Turkey now, you have the fact that you have a civil society movement, you have a majority of people who basically don't want the military to intervene, is a very important change. It's not really thanks to Erdogan. It's thanks to the last, I would say, 20 years of development in Turkey, the emergence of a society that respects the military but doesn't want it to be involved. As long as things will go fine in Turkey, economy will go fine, as long as basically there will be an absence of chaos, anarchy, people won't want a military intervention. And in that sense, I think that Turkey has passed a certain threshold in terms of income per capita, in terms of emerging of a middle class, in terms of establishing, although at a rudimentary level, certain checks and balances. It would be very difficult in Turkey, even if there was basically instability, to put tanks in the street and to have the military involved once again in running the country. Now, there can be different coups. There can be a postmodern coup. There can be, again, memorandums issued. That's another story. But I understand your question, and I link it to my analysis of saying that a lot of people, especially within the Gulen movement, think that the reason why we have reached this plateau now of basically days of a military coup are over, if we believe so, it's because of all the things that have been done, including the Ergenekon trial. If you get these guys out of jail, if you basically allow that to allow things to turn to business as usual, we may return to the old dark days where we suffered, where basically pious conservatives were thrown out of universities, where we couldn't go to the universities with our headscarves. That's the narrative of victimhood kicking in. In other words, the narrative of victimhood is so powerful, the threat perception is so powerful, that we are unable to create a normal society where threat perceptions are minimized and we basically are able to function without this zero-sum game world. I forgot the next part of your question. You had this.
It's okay. No, it's okay. One last question, please. Yes.
No, you're right, and I'm familiar with what Hoca Efendi said on this issue. He said, I think that we should not forget the larger issues here and that the headscarf should not be the driving factor. But that doesn't mean that there was no sense of empathy and a narrative related to this issue. So there were many other issues related to the narrative of victimhood, not just the headscarf, the fact that you would be discriminated against if your wife is wearing the headscarf. You would be discriminated against if you're a pious Muslim paying five times a day. I mean, those were in the dark days of basically, was they felt that they were basically living in an apartheid society. Why do you think this Black Turks, White Turks terminology emerged in terms of who really owns the country? It was the secularists. But the danger today is that you have the so-called White Turks themselves developing a similar narrative of victimhood, because they feel that they being challenged, they being discriminated against, they believe that what has rightly started as a legitimate campaign to go after the coup plotters, Ergenekon, has turned into a witch hunt against all the opponents of the regime. And interestingly, here it's the AKP that wants to put the brakes on, because they're suffering from this image of Turkey. And they have been the ones who have released Nedim Şener and Ahmet Şık. And I think it's very much related to the problem that had happened because of the intelligence issue, a mid-issue. And here we see basically AKP trying to say, look, we have reached a level of civil-military relations where we can afford some relaxation now. But I think because the Gulen movement felt much more threatened than the AKP itself from the military, there is this belief that we should still be very cautious. We should not relax because these dark days may come back. And that's the kind of paradox that Bernard was asking. I mean, normally you would expect the movement to say, okay, we're fine now. The military is in jail, et cetera. But things change and they may get out and they may come back with a vengeance. That's the fear. That's the fear of basically them coming back one day, taking revenge. I hate to end on a gloomy note.
Contrary to that final note, I think this has been a terrifically uplifting and informative and enlightening conference. I would like to ask all of you to join me in thanking our speakers, as well as all other speakers of today, and many individuals who worked very hard to make this possible. Thank